Hello and welcome to Pete's Percussion Podcast. I'm your host, Pete Zambito, and we're here for episode 260. Oh, another round number, yeah. And part one of my conversation with University of Texas at Permian Basin, percussion professor and current director of bands, Tim Fierst. We'll get back to Tim in a moment. But first up, a busy Saturday for Marching Mizzou. It began in Columbia at about 7 a.m. local time when we arrived at our band field and met up with Hickman High School, one of our local high schools, who was invited to play for our football game against Southeast Missouri State that Saturday in our place for a portion of the game. Now, why was this? Well, Marching Mizzou was invited to the Bicentennial Parade for the state of Missouri on that very same day in Jefferson City, which is a half hour south. The governor of Missouri specifically asked for us, along with Missouri State's band and my old band, Lincoln University's Marching Musical Storm, to perform as part of the festivities and parade. This presented somewhat of a problem because Saturday was a home game, and we had our early start time of 11 a.m. So what do you do about all this? Well, our Marching Mizzou director, Dr. Amy Knops, invited our most recent winner of our annual Champion of Champions Marching Band Festival, Hickman, to perform in our place. And according to all reports, they did a great job. And the football team was up by over 30 points at halftime. And we arrived at the field right in time for the second half and finished the game out. It was a long, hot day. The parade was in the low 80s, so not bad, but direct sunlight and no shade for that entire parade. It was even hotter for the game. Again, no shade. But in the end, the students performed fantastically. There were some grumblings here and there about Marching Mizzou not being at the entire game, but overall, a very proud day for the ensemble and a great day for Hickman High School's band. Okay, let's get to Tim Fierst. Tim and I met a few years back at one of the last in-person national conferences on percussion pedagogy. I believe that he was familiar with the show. He seemed to be up for being on it, and I'm glad he was. Tim's been working fairly recently at the University of Texas at Permian Basin and is, for the current year, the director of bands along with being the director of percussion activities. He's been active primarily as an educator throughout Texas and for a brief stint in Utah. His journey to this position has been a fascinating one with lots of stops along the way in part-time positions in his young career. He's also got a fascinating background with his growing up outside of Washington, D.C., going to various types of middle and high schools, and lots of teachers who were very important in his life. We went a bit long for this talk, so we split it up into two parts. On this portion, you'll hear about his current job, his wind band background, his various jobs out of his doctoral program, and his upbringing in Northern Virginia. In part two, we'll get to the rest of the story. So here we go. We recorded this interview over Zoom on August 29th, 2021, and it begins right now. So Tim, give me a summation of your percussion activities as they are right now.
Right now, I am Director of Percussion Studies at the University of Texas Permian Basin, where I teach percussion lessons. I also conduct the percussion ensemble. The percussion ensemble has just been selected to perform at the Texas Music Educators Association conference in February.
Great.
Which we're really excited about. We got lots of great stuff that we're planning for that. In addition to that, I also teach percussion methods. And we're on a, you know, every other year because we're on a 2-year course rotation schedule. So there, I teach both. We have two sections of percussion methods. We have one that is kind of more classically oriented, and the other one is kind of dedicated more towards, you know, drum set, marching band, world percussion, things like that. And then towards the end, I kind of added a little bit of a percussion ensemble lab, and I use Eric Rath and Ralph Hicks's book Beyond Basic Percussion, where they have, where each person has a piece that they can, that they are assigned. They have to do lesson plans for rehearsals and then conduct it. And then we video record them. And then at the end of it, if all goes according to plan, they all have a record, they all have like a video that they could take on job interviews with them. So they could show their principal or show whomever they're interviewing with that they can do that. In addition to that, I am also teaching music appreciation, a section of music appreciation, which is really fun for me to be able to just explain music to non-musicians. And although I have a couple of musicians in my family, I am kind of the first professional musician in my family. You know, growing up in the Washington, D.C. area, we had a lot of, you know, it's a family of government contractors, or, you know, in the D.C. area, you either work for the government or you contract with the government or some, or someplace in between. Of course, there are always exceptions to that. So being able to explain music to, you know, my family, I mean, that's basically what I do with music appreciation. We're also in a transition year right now. We will be conducting a search for a tenure track director of bands for fall 2022. And in the meantime, I am also serving as interim director of bands. So I am teaching marching band methods and also directing the entire marching band as well, the Spirit of the Permian Basin. Band sounding great. We just had our first week of classes. The band's about 70 people, but we have like a really, really big sound. And yeah, so we're just rocking and rolling with that. Dr. John Gomez, who is our orchestra conductor, is conducting the Symphonic Winds, our concert wind ensemble. So it's a pretty busy year, but you know, it's what I love doing. So that, and then in addition to that, I also teach adjunct at Odessa College, which is a community college in the Midland Odessa area, and I teach percussion lessons there. And there's also a campus drum line, which is kind of like a club there. So rather than an actual class, so they play for like campus events. Last year we played at this event where they raffled off a car to, you know, somebody. Cause I think that they had to, like, I can't remember what they had to do, but it was like some type of like contest to see who could do the most of something. And then those final six were then got together at this giant Ford dealer, and then they randomly pulled out a key fob and pressed the panic button. Whichever person was in front of that car, that was the one that they won and everything. So it was a really cool experience, and it's been very well received. You know, and that's the thing, is that drumline works so well at campus events. Sandra Woodley, who is our university president at UTPB, she is a very big drumline fan. And so she's always reaching out and saying like, can the drumline play, you know, play here? Like, she loves having the drumline at commencement, you know, convocation, things like that. So, you know, it's a really great place to be at where I am, and I'm living my best life right now. So I can't complain.
Explain again how you've organized and the way that you've thought about using the percussion methods course, because is the way that you set it up, are those two semesters required?
Yes, they're both are required. It's a late addition to the degree requirements. So people that already had their degree plans already filled out, you know, that's their contract with the university. So there's no ex post facto that goes with that. But you know, every incoming student, they do take both of those classes. And I should have clarified that a little bit earlier. But that's really cool, is that, you know, I know, you know, we talked to so many people in this business, like, gosh, there's only so much that we can teach in a semester, but now we got two semesters. So that really, it really is a great thing to have, and a really unique thing to have. So.
Well, it's useful in particular that it's a requirement. Cause one of the things that we have the challenges at Mizzou is that we have one semester that's a requirement. And then the other one is an option. So it is mm-hmm. set up to be a two semester thing, but it's been a challenge. But because the rules have been set up so that you need to have a certain amount to make, mm-hmm. it's really tough to get enough to do that second semester. So we've done some reorganizing, because I oversee that class here and have been for the last few years. And one of the challenges is that we now have to kind of try to get to everything a touch that first semester, and then try to open it up if we can get a second semester. And so that, and it's frustrating, but it's kind of the nature of the beast, as you've kind of alluded to.
You know, and that's the thing, is that we have to, you know, sort of reexamine, in my opinion, the way that we teach percussion methods. And I, you know, this is where kind of the controversy comes in with this, which is that, you know, we have to realize what our audience is with this class. You know, yes, we could spend a dedicated class talking about the techniques of a wind machine, for instance. I have nothing against wind machines, but that's just the first instrument that popped into my head. But, you know, we have to think about it from a place of practicality, you know? And so my goal is that at the end of these classes, do they have enough that they could manage a percussion program and have those beginning foundations of managing a percussion program in a band program where there's no dedicated percussion director, you know? And of course, being in Texas, there are more percussion directors than there are not percussion directors, but there are always exceptions to that rule, number one. And two, what I tell my students is I want them to not just be limited by Texas. I want them to feel like they could go teach anywhere in the United States, you know, whether it's Texas, whether it's the major metropolitan area of Texas or Ritchie County, West Virginia. You know, I can talk about Ritchie County, West Virginia, because it's a very beautiful area. But it is a little bit remote, and, you know, a lot of my mom's side of the family lives in Ritchie County, West Virginia. So, but then, you know, they're at a place like that, they would have to manage everything, you know, a band, maybe even an orchestra, you know, who knows, maybe even a choir. You just never know. So I don't want my students to be limited by Texas, although Texas is fantastic. I love living in Texas, but I just don't want them to be limited by that.
Yeah, no, I hear you. So how did you first get the position at Permian Basin?
What happened was, is that, so before that I was teaching at Tyler. I was teaching adjunct percussion. So I was teaching the lesson ensembles and methods at UT Tyler.
And at the same time, at this point, are you done with your doctorate?
Yes, I graduated in 2017 with my doctorate from the University of North Texas. And then fall 2019 is when I started teaching at Tyler. So at the same time, Student Success hired a drumline position, hired somebody for drumline, Oni Lara, who is awesome. He also got his doctorate he got his doctorate at UT Austin. I got my master's there, and he started after I left. And Oni is now in the Army Ceremonial Band in Washington, D.C. And so what happened was, is that they wanted to combine my position in the Department of Music with this drumline position in Student Success to create a full-time lecture position. And then what happened was, and this was all during the shutdowns and everything, they had the search, you know, I made it to the final round, and another candidate was selected, which is, you know, it's completely fine. I completely understand it. And rather than, you know, wallowing in the dust about what had happened and kind of, although I was sad to be leaving Tyler, I just said, all right, you have one of two choices. You can either completely give up on doing this, because of course, you know, we're seeing searches canceled all over the place, you know, for all of these positions because of the virus, or you can just start just sending out emails and emails and emails. And I had known for a while that my predecessor at UT Permian Base, UTPB, Tyson Voigt, who now teaches at Southeastern University in Lakeland, Florida, was leaving. I had known that for a while. My good friend Jacob Garcia, who is section percussion in the Midland Odessa Symphony and Chorale, and also principal percussionist of the Texarkana Symphony, and he lives in the DFW area, a very, very close friend of mine. And I told him about that I interviewed for the position and another candidate was selected. And he said, check out UTPB, see if they filled it out. So what I filled that position. So what had happened was kind of a series of excellent timing, you know, and I'm kind of one of these people that believes everything happens for a reason. You are always lined up to do the thing that you're meant to do, whether you realize it at the time or not. So what happened was, is I emailed Kevin Richardson, who was the director of bands at the time, and said, told him about that I was teaching at UT Tyler. Another candidate was selected. I'm looking for work. Has this position been filled yet? And so Kevin contacted me and we chatted on the phone. And he basically said that right as I sent my CV, UTPB had, or the is that the UTPB or the UT system, one of those two, had just lifted their hiring freeze. And at the time, the percussion position was adjunct. Now it's in this, combined with my interim director of bands for this 1 year visiting lecture, but I digress. And so he said, you know, I'm ready to hire you right now. You have great resume and you have a great, great pedigree, you know, you have great experience, you know, and we get along very well. And, you know, he said, you know, would you like the job? And I was like, you betcha, you bet I do. And, you know, the success of the program, you know, we're, you know, we have 10 majors, you know, we have 11 in percussion ensemble. A lot of them, you know, also carry over into the drum line, and we have non-majors in the drum line as well. You know, I really want to credit Tyson for doing a lot of the heavy lifting in the beginning, you know, because he was one of those people that really, really grew that program before I arrived. And I'm very fortunate to be moving that rock forward to keep growing it. And now we're performing at TMEA. So that's how I got the job at UTPB, was through that. And it was just incredible lucky timing. And, you know, and it's really a great place to work. We have great colleagues. I have great colleagues. The students are fantastic, you know, very hard workers. It really is the best job for me. And, you know, and I wake up every day extremely grateful that I have it.
Yeah. Very cool. So this is year two for you there?
Yes, this is year two for me. Okay.
This position that you're doing right now, where you're interim director of bands, do you have band experience before? Or did this kind of just open up and they kind of needed you to cover it?
Kind of both, actually. So I do, my related field at the University of North Texas is wind band conducting. Oh. You know, so I do have a little bit of experience being on the podium. I also, my undergraduate is in music education, and I did my student teaching through band and everything. And, you know, the most influential teachers that I've had over the years, most of them were band directors, you know, at one point or another, you know, my high school band director, Michael Hackbarth, my band director at George Mason University, was conductor of the Wind Symphony, Mark Camphouse, John Kilkenny, who was my first percussion teacher way back when I was in middle school and is now director of percussion studies at George Mason University. He also conducts the symphonic band. And then going to my master's and being under the baton of Jerry Junkin in the UT Wind Ensemble. And then later, as I was working on my doctorate at UNT and freelancing in the DFW area, being able to be under his baton again in the Dallas Winds. And then, you know, Eugene Corporon and Dennis Fisher, who had since retired, at University of North Texas. So I felt comfortable in that I could see the ship, you know, I could oversee it and keep the ship from running into any icebergs or anything. And no, but of course, you know, band directing is not, I respect it. You know, it's not really, you know, I'm much better at like teaching percussion, and might need to edit this out a little bit, but like, I also say that like my passion is percussion, you know, but when they said, would you be able to do this? I just said, yeah, absolutely. You know, and I said that without a hesitation, because to my way of thinking, a healthy band means a healthy percussion studio, and in a healthy band also means a healthy music department, you know, and that's just the way, you know, it is in everything. And there are, you know, people out there who are trying to get those tenure track director of bands positions. I would not say that I am one of those people. However, this was like an opportunity right here, and the music department really needed me to step up. So I was more than happy to.
When you decided to take this other concentration, was that intentional? Or was it just, I might as well do this too, because I'm around these other directors?
Mark Ford advised me to do that because it was kind of at a time where we were seeing a lot in academic job searches. We were seeing a lot of combinations of percussion positions and athletic bands positions as well. And so it was kind of something that they viewed was kind of one of the more marketable related fields. But at the same time, I also felt like I could learn a lot from just plain old musicianship. I remember when I was student teaching at the end of my undergrad, I learned so much about music just from conducting band, you know, much more about phrasing and musicality, you know, dynamics, direction. And I'm not saying that percussion doesn't have one of those things, but depending on the situation and depending on one's perception, those qualities can be a little less obvious than somebody that, you know, conducts a band and everything. And so with the related field, I took two wind band literature classes that Eugene Corporon taught. There was also a conducting class that Dennis Fisher, who taught at the time. And then there was also, you know, ensemble requirement of being in, you know, the North Texas Wind Symphony, which I was already in. And then there was a summer conducting collegium or conducting workshop. They call it the collegium, where we talk about repertoire in the beginning, and then in the afternoon there are conducting sessions with the North Texas Wind Symphony during the summer, and you get a great conducting video out of that and everything. And then after the conducting workshop concludes, that's usually when they do their recording sessions. So if you look at the Teaching Music Through Performance in Band books and repertoire and CDs and everything, it's usually during the summer when those recording sessions happen. And so, you know, it was kind of something I just said, you know, I'm in my doctorate. I want to be the best musician that I can. But at the same time, I also realize that I have to have a marketability of skills. And this was something that of all the related fields out there, this one was a little bit more familiar to me. I was, you know, I grew up around bands and around band directors, you know, always got along with band directors. So I just said, let's just give it a shot. And it was one of the best decisions I ever made.
Clearly. Tell me a little bit about the school. Has it been around a long time? Is this the name it's always been under? Is it, it helps the size of the student body and the school music student body, that kind of stuff?
So the music program specifically, it's a growing program. We have about between 70 to 80 majors. We are housed in the Midland campus of University of Texas Permian Basin, while the main campus is in Odessa. Now, what's really cool is that our facilities are really awesome, in that we share them with the Wagner Noel Performing Arts Center, which is this independent performing arts center, and they host artists like ZZ Top, Diana Ross, and everything. But our concerts are also held in that concert hall as well. And so if you look at a picture of the building online, you see the big Wagner Noel Performing Arts Center, and that's also where the Midland Odessa Symphony and Chorale plays. And then to the right of that, that's where the music department is and everything. And so, so we have great facilities. We also use this building called the Seed Building, which is CEED building, which is also on the Midland campus, which is where some theory classes and some seminars in music are taught. The university as a whole, you know, when people think about the University of Texas, they immediately think UT Austin. They think, you know, UT El Paso, mm-hmm. you know, so forth and so on. UTPB is really, in my opinion, really hot right now. We're seeing a lot of growth. I confess, right, you know, on the spot, I don't really have the exact numbers right now, but we're seeing a lot of growth, not only in the music area, but also, you know, in the university as a whole. And, you know, we're really grateful for that, especially at a time where we're seeing a lot of low enrollments and everything. So, you know, things are happening here, and it's a really amazing to witness it, to be a part of something where we can just simply just grow. And, you know, and there are certain benefits to it, because then that means that you always have to be growing. You can't get complacent with recruiting and things like that. You know, if you're this very well-known music program, you probably maybe don't need to worry about recruiting as much, although they recruit as well. So, you know, we are slightly on the smaller side right now. However, we're seeing this big explosion of interest and everything right now. So we're having excellent momentum right now.
That's great. Two things. One is, what part of Texas is your school in? And then follow up, have you read Friday Night Lights?
So I'll answer the second question first, which is that I have not read Friday Night Lights. I know why you're asking that question, and it is a cardinal sin that I have not that I have not read that or have watched it. I know of it. I know it takes place in Odessa and everything. It's on the list. It's on the list. I've just been a little bit.
Yeah, I've never watched the TV show. The film on the book is very good. The book is incredible. Like just as a work of nonfiction, it's fantastic.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, and I'm really looking forward to checking it out. It's on my list. Now, the first answer to your first question. So, Midland and Odessa, which are kind of two cities that are located close to each other. So it's kind of like, you know, it's kind of like the two towers, you know, you got your Mordor and Isengard type thing. So, sure. You know, we throw a little bit of Lord of the Rings in there and everything, but it's in.
Yeah, I'm a huge fan of Star Wars. Sure. Go ahead. No.
I'm talking about Lord of the Rings.
No, I know. Yes.
Oh, okay. I see what you mean. Yeah. All right. So, it's located in West Texas. So, We're about 2 hours south of Lubbock, and we're about 5.5 hours ish east of El Paso. We're about 2 hours west of Abilene, and we're about 5 hours north of San Antonio. So we're kind of but it's all considered West Texas. So we're kind of next to ourselves, right? A little bit, yeah. But you know, that's the case with some other places and everything. So,
well, that's a typical answer to where Lubbock is. It's near itself. UTEP, El Paso is near itself. Like, all these places are near itself, basically.
Yeah, absolutely. So, yeah, but I think, you know, we're relatively close to Abilene. If you're driving from Dallas westward towards Midland, Odessa, and my West Texas friends that are listening to this, if I get this wrong, you know, I apologize, but like Abilene is kind of like that last major city that you hit before you get to the Midland, Odessa area. Midland is east of Odessa. We kind of go back and forth between the two campuses and everything.
With the job in, you know, your responsibilities increasing, does that mean that you are on not a adjunct thing, or is it still for the year an adjunct thing?
So for this year, I was promoted to a visiting lecturer position. So I was adjunct last year. This year I am full time.
Awesome.
So, which is, you know, if you go from adjunct to full time, we know in this business how it's the golden goose is the full time position. Now, this is just a 1 year appointment, but you better believe I'm taking advantage of it, you know, and everything. So, you know, and I, of course, I mean that in the nicest way possible.
Yeah, yeah.
And
no, everything, but the benefits. I got you. Yeah.
Yeah. No, for sure. So to answer your question, last year I was adjunct. This year I'm full time.
When you were finishing up your doctorate, were you already teaching aside from doing your doctorate, or was the Tyler thing and related the first thing out of the gate?
While I was at the University of North Texas and working on my doctorate, I was one of the teaching fellows right there. And for those of you who don't know about these teaching fellowships at North Texas, they're really awesome. You get a full load of music major students, and then you also have additional duties, whether it's working in the office or teaching a percussion methods course or teaching one of the percussion ensembles. So it's almost an adjunct workload right there. And between that and all the, you know, kind of the gigging that I was doing, you know, I was doing some subbing with Dallas Winds. Occasionally I would, you know, towards the end of my doctorate, I would sub a little bit with Amarillo Symphony. So I would go out of town with that. I did a little bit of work at this Jasper High School, which is in the Plano ISD, which feeds into Plano West, and which is it's a 9th and 10th grade high school, and then Plano West is an 11th and 12th grade. So I kind of told myself, you know, that I really wanted to focus on my studies and I wanted to make sure that I finished my doctorate, and I was really busy at UNT. So I kind of made the decision to not reach out and teach private lessons while I was working on my doctorate, you know, outside of the ones that I was teaching already in my teaching fellowship. And then after I graduated, you know how it is when you finish your DMA and then you find out, oh, maybe I'm not going to get that tenure track job right as I finish my DMA, you know, and that was kind of what I experienced. And of course it wasn't to the fault of any of my teachers. It's just the nature of the job market. So what ended up happening was, so I interviewed for a couple positions, and, you know, came close to a couple of them, but they hired somebody with more experience, as they should have. They needed to hire somebody that had experience and everything. And so what happened was that, as I was finishing up my doctorate, there was this community college located in Gainesville, which is about 50 minutes north of Denton, where UNT is, called North Central Texas College. And Adam Davis, who was who's another close friend of mine, he and I were working on our master's together at UT Austin. Then we were working on our doctorates together at the University of North Texas. He was teaching there, and then he got a sabbatical replacement offer at Ouachita Baptist University. Mm-hmm. That was in the spring. And then I think in the fall was Henderson State University, but they're both in Arkadelphia, Arkansas. And so he left, and he recommended me for the percussion position there. And there I taught a couple students. But it was my first letterhead, and so I was really excited about that. The director of bands there was Chris McGinty, who was also working on it, who was finishing up his doctorate, or had finished his doctorate at UNT. And Chris McGinty's now in the Air Force concert band in DC. You're starting to sense a pattern here. Like, all these people I know are all of a sudden living in DC, where my hometown is and everything. Nice. So I taught at North Central Texas College for a year. And then University of Utah percussion program was advertising a 1-year adjunct position to assist with the drumline and also teach some lessons and such. And so I applied for that, and that put me in touch with Mike Sammons, who runs the percussion program there. And he offered me the position, and I happily accepted. So I ended up teaching on the faculty at the University of Utah for a year. So I relocated to Salt Lake City. That was honestly like the best year for me, because I grew so much as a teacher and so much as an artist. Mike Sammons, who you should have on this program if you haven't already, is one of the best music educators that I've ever worked with. His approach to everything, about how it's just, you know, his ideas on brand and his entrepreneurial ideas, you know, very innovative ideas for stuff, was just really eye-opening. And he possessed teaching qualities that I needed, like the exact same teaching qualities that he uses was what I needed. And so being able to spend a year with Mike and really grow as a teacher was something that I wouldn't trade it for anything. You know, that was a really big turning point for my teaching. So then So that only lasted for a year. And then I got my notice that it wasn't going to be renewed, which I knew was going to happen, which is fine. And so what I did was, is I went to National Conference on Percussion Pedagogy in Lubbock. And at the time I didn't have anything else lined up. So I said, okay, I can always go back to the Dallas-Fort Worth area, because when I was teaching at North Central Texas College, I was also teaching private lessons in the Little Elm Independent School District, a little bit in the Richardson Independent School District as well, you know, just driving all over the place. And so what happened was, is that while I was there, I got a text from Corey Robinson, who had been teaching at UT Tyler and Texas Women's University at the time. And he said, hey, I'm leaving these colleges. Do you want me, would you like for me to recommend you? And I said, absolutely. I remember when that happened, I can't remember who was giving the presentation, but I was there on my laptop, you know, taking notes from NCPP. And then Corey sends me this text and everything. And I had already planned to, if I hadn't said this already, I'd already planned to come back to the DFW area. Cause what happened was that I went from Salt Lake City, flew to Lubbock, and then I was going to spend, you know, 3 or 4 days in the DFW area, just rebuilding my contracts, you know, just seeing a bunch of friends and everything. And then fly back to Virginia to spend the summer with my parents. And while I was there, I remember exactly when this happened. I was going to try and get together with Christopher Dean during that time. So I was in the parking lot of the Denton Whataburger on Loop 288, Loop 288. And he called me back. He said, unfortunately, I'm very busy right now. And we just can't meet up. But did you hear about Corey? And I just said, no, what happened? And he said, well, I only knew that he was leaving those positions. And he said, well, Corey got the job at Midwestern State University in Wichita Falls, Texas. So if I were you, I would email like the director of the School of Performing Arts, who was Jeff Engie at the time, immediately saying, hey, I heard that you have this open percussion position. You know, here's my CV. This is what I've done and everything. And so I did that. And then we emailed each other back and forth. And while I was building up these contacts and everything and, you know, getting lunch with people and everything, Jeff emailed me and he said, if you're actually already in town, would you be able to drive to Tyler and interview for the position? And can you do a little bit of playing for us as well? Now, fortunately, I had already had my suit with me, you know, and I already had like some music that I had been working on just in the event that I got called for for an interview that involved a playing component and everything. So what I did was, is I had to cut lunch short with my friend, Oliver Delato is who it was. He was he was teaching at MacArthur High School. Now he's at Tarpon Springs, percussion director at Tarpon Springs High School in Florida, really successful band program. I went to my hotel in Denton and then I pulled out Elliot Carter's Improvisation, you know, and I had played that off and on for a number of years. So I took about, you know, it took me a couple minutes to kind of get that under there. And then I just played Process of Invention on a faculty recital, Christopher Dean's Process of Invention, on a faculty recital at the University of Utah. So I worked on that a little bit. And of course it's a 15-minute work, which is it's a fantastic work, you know, but maybe like an excerpt of it is more appropriate for like a search committee and stuff like that. So I love the piece. Chris, if you're listening to this, I love the piece wholeheartedly. And it's really holds a special place in my heart. And then I also did the first movement of Nicholas Martin Child's Impressions, you know, which is for the snare drum and the two toms and everything. So I remembered those things. I rushed down to the hotel lobby. I said, hey, could I get these pieces of music printed just so I could, you know, be able to facilitate the page turns and everything. And then I got in my car and drove about 2 hours east of Denton to Tyler, Texas to interview for the position. And so I interviewed for it. I played and then I went back to Virginia a couple days later. I got the call and they offered me the position. So, you know, and then I was there and then I relocated to UTPB. And so, you know, looking back on it, everything that happened was like perfect timing for me. And like everything happened for a reason. I was at the exact same exact right place that I needed to be every single time. And it's really actually just unbelievable in to my way of thinking when I think back on it, just how I happened to be in the DFW area when they said, hey, could you come interview for this position and everything. And it's just, it's really remarkable. And, you know, and I use this as a kind of an advice for your listeners, which is that although it might not seem it at the time, and although we think that we should be at this place, or we think that we're not where we're supposed to be, well, really you're where you need to be right now. You might not realize it at the time, but I can guarantee you in a few years, you're going to look back on those times and you're going to realize, you know what? That's exactly where I needed to be at the time, you know, and I guarantee you that's going to be the case.
Yeah, that's a good story. Wait, and you had your mallets with you?
Yeah, I did.
You just did, or you because you were you had them for a previous reason?
Well, I had them in my suitcase because I just said, look, positions could open up over the summer. I need to be ready to play at a moment's notice. And that was actually a piece of advice that Mark Ford had given to me, which he said, you know, those interviews can pop up, you know, at a moment's notice. So make sure that you have some things ready to go. And so I had my, you know, I had my professional dress with me, and I did have my, my sticks and mallets with me. And so I was able to play. I did have to get a pair of drumsticks though, cause I had to play a little bit of drum set. So I rushed over to the Guitar Center and got some 5A's
nice
to help for that and everything. So
plastic tip or wood?
Wood tip.
Gotcha.
You see, those are the questions right there.
So. Right. Yeah. Hopefully you had a choice on that one.
You would think, yeah. I think I did have a choice in everything.
Yeah. I mean, that's good. I mean, just to remember to put that in your bag. Like, I guess I don't need the sweatpants. Stick mallet.
Oh, well, you know, it's the advice that Mark Ford gave me and that my teachers gave me, that it's always good to have stuff ready to go at a moment's notice, you know? So if your teachers tell you that, be sure you listen to that, because that's what happened with me. Yeah. Is that I had this very last minute, like, hey, can you come play for us? And I just said, oh, yes. Well, yes, I can. You know, so I didn't have to run around, you know, make a trip to Lone Star Percussion, buy a bunch of mallets, and then be like, oh, how did that one solo go again? Can I remember Dances of Earth and Fire in 5 minutes? Mm. So.
Maybe.
Maybe. Maybe. Yeah. It depends.
That piece is hard.
God, it is. But you know, it's such a rewarding piece to play and everything. And I played that piece for my master's recital at UT Austin. And that was just a great kind of crowning moment for me, was to be able to play that piece, because I had always wanted to play it. I first heard that piece in high school because John Kilkenny played it for a bunch of students, and it just all the different colors and everything in that first movement, and just the melodic and color, you know, qualities of that second movement, they just really do, you know, complement each other. Peter wrote an amazing, amazing work with that one. And I know that they say that like your favorite piece is the one that you're working on right now. And there is some truth to that, but Dances of Earth and Fire will always hold a special place in my heart. That piece and the process of invention are kind of the two marimba solos that, you know, that have a lot of sentimental value with me, you know, for Process of Invention. And I recorded it for Vic Firth, and you know, submitted it on the YouTube channel. You can go check it out and everything. And being able to work on that piece with Chris, you know, and having the lessons on it and everything, and to be able to grow on that piece musically and, you know, emotionally and everything, you know, I will always cherish those lessons that I had, playing Process of Invention for Chris.
Cool. So are you actually in DC or are you on the outskirts of DC that you grew up?
Great question.
Cause that is, it's like Atlanta is the same thing. New York City. Like there's lots of cities where you're like, okay, did you actually? Yeah. Anyway, sorry.
Yeah. Go ahead. That is a great question. And I grew up in a suburb of DC, which is, in Northern Virginia, specifically Fairfax County. Mm-hmm. Even more specifically, this town called Vienna, Virginia. Mm-hmm. You know, if people ask you, "Hey, are you from Virginia?" if they ask you, "Hey, where are you from?" and you say Virginia, and they're like, "Oh, I've been to Virginia Beach, or I've been to Richmond, I've been to Norfolk." But yeah, Washington D.C. is a lot closer to that northern part than anything else. So what ended up happening was there was actually this pretty funny meme that was passed along Northern Virginia people, or Nova as we call it, which it says like, "Where are you from?" "Virginia." And they said, "Oh, like Virginia Beach? No. Richmond? No. Newport News? No. Norfolk, Virginia? Norfolk? No." And then it finally says, "I live in DC. I'm from Washington, DC. I live in the White House," you know, just like that absurdist thing. So yeah, it's become a lot easier for me to just say I'm from Washington, DC, because then that just saves some clarification in everything. And DC is also a very big commuter city, which is that most people that work in DC do not live in DC. They either live in Maryland to the north or Virginia to the south and everything. So I was born and raised in Vienna, Virginia. Grew up there. It was a great place to grow up. Very well-to-do upper middle class area, and lived there for 22 years. You know, I did my undergraduate at George Mason University, which is in Fairfax, Virginia, which was about 20 minutes where I lived. And, you know, and so it was, again, it was a great, great area to grow up in.
Yeah. Now, you said your mom's family is from Richards County? Is that what it was?
So they currently live in Ritchie County, West Virginia. My mom's side of the family is originally from Prince George's County, Maryland, okay, specifically this town called Maryland. They just recently relocated but they've lived in West Virginia for a while. And Ritchie County is kind of specifically the town's called Pullman. And it's like right in the middle of West Virginia. And so like we would always go out there for, you know, Thanksgiving. You know, my dad would go hunting for deer, you know, and we'd have like a big Thanksgiving feast. And it was a tradition for many, many years.
I used to teach at Concord in West Virginia, okay, which is way south, which is basically in Southwest Virginia. I mean, it's right near, which is another part of Virginia you're not from, either Roanoke or Blacksburg.
Blackburn, Brandon. Harrisonburg, yeah. You know, Harrisonburg, where Casey is at JMU, yeah, and everything. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. But you see kind of the conundrum, which is just that you say you're from Virginia and they say, "Oh, you're from Virginia Beach." And I just said, "No, I live in Washington, D.C. Let's just go with that."
I hear you. So you've just cut off the conversation because you're like, this is going to take a while.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's not that I find it frustrating. It's sure. Just that, you know, I can either. So what I started saying was that I'm from Northern Virginia, just outside Washington, D.C. Mm-hmm. You know, I start saying that because if I start saying, you know, Virginia, then all that happens. And then it's like, you can know exactly how the conversation is going to go in anything. Now, of no offense to people that have taken the conversation that way, of course.
Of course. Yeah. It's not an offense taken. It's just I have a way to reroute this back to.
Oh yeah. Yeah. You will, at the end of the time, you will know exactly where I live, and we will save a bunch of time.
Yeah. Exactly.
So this is the discount. So
Now, because I think you had alluded to that your folks had like government, they worked in government related jobs. Were these things, and there's a reason I'm asking this, is that were these jobs that were like, sometimes there are jobs where it's like, you don't actually know what they really do because of like,
mm-hmm. If you ask somebody if they work for the company, that's code for, do they work for the CIA?
Yes. Yeah, right.
like I think there was some CIA movie out there called like The Company or something like that. But okay, said, you know, if you look at, we're going to go really deep dive into films right here, and then I will answer your question.
I'm here for it.
The first Mission Impossible movie with Tom Cruise and Vanessa Redgrave, who played an arms dealer called Max, mm-hmm. Who was meeting with Ethan Hunt, who is Tom Cruise's character. And she said, are you a company man? You know, and that's what they mean, you know, because they're their Impossible Mission Force was a group inside the CIA. So to answer your question, I sort of know what my parents do. Both of my parents are contractors. Yeah. My mom is an instructional designer and has worked with various government agencies, including National Archives, some things in healthcare. She did some contracts for this thing called Anti-Terrorism Assistance, which is a branch of the State Department. Worked a lot with Customs and Border Patrol and everything. And what she does is that she helps format these courses, like these training courses, for instance. She's doing a lot of contract work. She's now mostly in the private sector now, doing contracts with this consulting company called Allen Interactions. And she works from home. And so they have contracts with companies like ExxonMobil and New York Life. So whenever you take training, like for instance, harassment in the workplace or cybersecurity, things like that, and you read all those different scenarios, mm-hmm. Such and such keeps files on this. Is this an example of breach of protocol? And it's all formatted like that. My mom is one of the types of people that writes those scenarios and also helps to format that. So all the different training that you take, you know, those are done through instructional design.
Gotcha. Yeah.
Now my father is an aerospace mechanical engineer, also a government contractor, and she contracts with the, I can't remember exactly. But I believe he contracts through Praxis, this company called Praxis, which contracts with the Department of the Navy. But basically he contracts and works at the Naval Research Laboratory, which is near Anacostia in Washington, D.C. Mm-hmm. And so so what he does is he does a lot of design of satellites. Mm. So they say, hey, we have this specific payload that we want to put in there. And one of my dad's responsibilities is using, you know, like a CAT program and everything to see how it can all fit on the spacecraft that needs to fit inside a Delta rocket. And mm-hmm. so he's worked on stuff that has gone up into space, that's launched, in Cape Canaveral, Florida. Mm-hmm. Kodiak Island, which is off the coast of Alaska as well. And so, you know, it's just like a bunch of like, you know, different things like that. And it's actually really cool what he does and everything. And absolutely. And so it actually got to the point where they were asking my mom, like, what type of work are you in? And she would say, and at the time she was doing a lot of like counterterrorism forensics courses. And she says, well, I basically work in counterterrorism. Now she's not a subject matter expert, but she's somebody that talks to a subject matter expert who is a expert in that field. And then she takes that information and comes up with scenarios. Like she did a stint with ATA, Anti-Terrorism Assistance, where what they would do is they would teach this specific counterterrorism forensics course for local authorities, like for instance in Barbados, St. Kitts, Manila, in the Philippines, and everything. And they would teach it to the local authorities and pilot the course and everything, which was really interesting. And so what they would do is she would sit in the back of the classroom with a stopwatch, because they call the first time that they teach the course, it's called piloting a course. Mm-hmm. and she would see like how it flows and everything. And then they had actual specific instructors there. One guy was the name of Joe Blozos, who was a former New York City detective, who he had been a technical consultant for shows like CSI and everything. And, and he was actually in one of the towers on 9/11 and when it started collapsing. And sadly, you know, he ran out and his partner was right behind him and he made it out, but his partner didn't.
Oh, wow.
And then another person was Susan Clutter, who's a detective who's a crime scene investigator with Baltimore Homicide. So my mom has worked with actually a lot of really interesting people, including people that interviewed Robert Hansen, who was the person that was the largest security breach in history. That movie Breach by Chris Cooper was about Robert Hansen.
Okay.
And also she's worked with FBI people that that actually directly interviewed and interrogated Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who was the mastermind of 9/11 and stuff like that. So they're both government contractors, although my mom's kind of more in the private sector now and everything. So, and now they're both working from home with everything going on. And my dad doesn't miss the commute to Washington, D.C., having to brave that obstacle course that is the Capitol Beltway.
Yeah, yeah, of course. Now that's very cool. That's and you come in, you're like, and I play the drums.
Right? Well, that's actually kind of interesting because, so many of us have had, one of the questions that musicians are always asked is, did your parents discourage you, mm-hmm. from being in music? Now, although, my dad plays guitar and has actually recorded songs, and he's a songwriter and has played performances, and my mom knows a little bit of guitar. They did not, and even though they're both working, these non-music jobs, they never once discouraged me from pursuing music, because they wanted me to be happy, and I understand why some parents are hesitant to have their children go into music, but I never really had that issue. They wanted me to be happy. They wanted me to go for it and everything. And, that's something I'm always extremely grateful for, that I never really had much resistance when I said I wanted to, I wanted to be a career musician.
Yeah. Yeah. That's great. Before I move on, I am curious, what is the origin of your last name?
Oh, it's German. Fürst is German. I believe the story goes that it used to be like F-I-E-R-S-T. And then when my ancestors came to America and they went to Ellis Island, they changed the spelling to F-E-E-R-S-T. But to the best of my knowledge, I believe it is German.
Got it.
I know I have a lot of German heritage, so,
It seems so. Like, because the two E's make me think like Dutch, because there's a lot of double E's in that, but it explains it that that's not the spelling that the original spelling.
Yeah. What I do know for sure, and by sure, I mean in the 90% and upward.
In the A range.
Well, in the A range. Well, this is stuff I haven't thought about in years. So sure. I have to make sure that I'm not spouting any fake news or anything.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is that the spelling was changed, when my ancestors, came through Ellis Island. And I'm pretty sure that the last name is German in origin.
Cool. So how
Ooh, great questions, man.
Oh, thanks.
Great questions. I love it.
How does percussion first enter your life then?
This is a very interesting story, is that it's always kind of been there and I always was interested in it, but I never really realized it until much later. So what happened was, I wasn't one of these people that thought I want to be Ringo Starr when I grow up. I want to be Neil Peart when I when I when I grow up, or I, you know, I grew up listening to rock and roll and just playing along. You know, I did have a little bit of the classic, you know, playing on pots and pans, you know, on my grandmother's pots and pans. There's like a bit, there's like a picture out there of me doing that when I was a baby. So, basically the way that it started was that, my parents were trying to find an activity for me to do that wasn't sitting around and playing video games day in and day out. And so first started with, you know, trying to do sports. It never really, I did like 1 year of Little League, baseball. It was fun, but I just never really felt a connection for it. I then did some piano. I took some piano lessons from a family friend. And I had fun with piano. I liked playing piano. And then I did I think about 1.5 to 2 years of that. And then after that, I kind of started to get into a little bit of drama and acting. You know, I always been, for a while I was just like, I want to be a director. I want to be an actor, but I just never really, but I guess I just didn't really like wearing the makeup, you know, that goes with production. So I did a couple stage productions, youth oriented. One was called How to Eat Like a Child and other lessons on how to not be a grown up. And then I was one of the brothers in Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat, and they were it was this theater company called the Vienna Youth Players, which was at the community center in my hometown. I cherish those memories, but it wasn't really something I wanted to do long term. It just didn't really fit. Now, throughout the year,
not even the Calypso song from Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat.
You know. I see what you're going with that, you know, and that is a really good song. Although Those Canaan Days is a really good song as well. You know, that's a really good song too. So while all of this was going on, so you have to realize that also I was in elementary school, and I from kindergarten through third grade, I went to public school, and then I transferred to a small private Christian school in Reston, Virginia, called the Academy of Christian Education. And they didn't have a band program there. And so I didn't really experience elementary band, but I remember when I was a kid that I would see that they would play the Star Spangled Banner at like an assembly or a pep rally or something like that. And I thought, and my eyes always gravitated towards the drums. There was somebody that came in also during that time that I think it was called Percussion Discussion. Don't ask me who gave the presentation. I have no idea who it was, but he would do all these like different demonstrations on drums. He would use this like electronic drum pad and make all these cool sounds. And I thought, oh gosh, that's really cool. And then, you know, when I was at the Academy of Christian Education, we would start each day, because it was a Christian education, we would start each day singing praise songs and stuff like that, you know, as part of the morning devotions and everything. And we did this thing where we would sing and play along with this song, and we would all have like different instruments and stuff like that. And I always wanted to play the bongos because I would just wail on those bongos and everything. Little did I know what was actually happening, that the spark was being kindled right there. So it got to the point where, it was after I graduated from sixth grade, and in Virginia, seventh and eighth grade is considered middle school. And my parents had already made the decision to homeschool me for seventh and eighth grade. And my mom came to me and said, there's this thing called Vienna Band Camp, which is a 1 week concert band camp where you learn the instruments and then you have a concert for it. And I kind of just said, you know, and we were kind of burned out on trying to find activities for me. And I kind of said very facetiously, because you have to remember I was 12 at the time, I said, what, so I can like play the clarinet? No offense to clarinet players out there, you know. And she said, no, how about percussion? And I just sat there and I just said, let's give it a try. So what ended up happening was I attended the Vienna band camp, and they had like four levels from beginning all the way to advanced. I was in the beginning group because I'd never played percussion before. And the two instructors that were there were Aubrey Adams, who had just recently retired from the Air Force Band. And the other instructor was John Kilkenny, who had, this was before he was at George Mason University. And to my mom, what my mom says is that was the first time that I ever got in the car and absolutely loved the activity that I was doing. And so like there, I was playing with it. I was playing with a band. Like we played like this, we played out of the Standards and Excellence band book. We played, like this little, grasshopper tune. And then we played Hang On Sloopy, like this very beginning elementary stuff. But I was like hooked after that. I was just like, this is awesome. My parents reached out to John and I started studying percussion with John. And then, so I did that for 2 years and that was a very interesting time because, this was right around the time 9/11 happened. And then also being in DC, we had the scare of anthrax as well.
Yeah.
And then after that was the, Beltway sniper attacks.
Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So amidst all of that, I was, learning percussion and everything. And I can't really say whether it kind of gave me comfort to learn music, but music has very healing properties. And it was nice to be able to just play drums while the world was falling apart and everything, at least, my world and everything, because when you have three of those events, 9/11, anthrax and the sniper, it's really, it was really traumatizing. 9/11 was pretty traumatizing for me, especially since, being in the suburb of a city that got hit, actually being in the same state, because the Pentagon is located in Arlington, Virginia, right, as opposed to actual Washington, D.C. And, the flight that flew into the Pentagon actually flew over our house. So, So it was a really, really, interesting couple of years. So I kept taking lessons with John, and then, it got time for me to go to high school, and my parents had decided that they wanted me to be in a public high school. And in order to experience, a full band experience. So I went to James Madison High School, where Michael Hackbarth, who is my high school band director, and he's still there, teaches. And the percussion director at the time there was a man by the name of Doug Wallace, who is another freelance person, there. And I really learned so much from him, and I was continuing lessons with John. And then my high school drumline instructor is James Swartz, who is the principal percussionist of the Navy Band. And that was kind of one of the cool things about growing up in that area is that, I had such amazing teachers that really knew a whole lot and really could teach very well as well. And what's kind of interesting is that, John, Doug, and Jim, they all studied with Alan Abel. They all got degrees from Juilliard. John and Jim got their undergrads from Juilliard, and Doug got his master's at Juilliard. So it's like you had these three very big teachers and everything that had a lot of pedigree and a lot of experience, and they would play with the National Symphony, and things like that. So they had a real unique insight into concert percussion. I marched bass drum for 2 years, then I marched snare for 2 years, and just really grew on that. And it was a little bit of an adjustment though, because outside of Deanna Band Camp, I'd never played in a school band before until I got to high school, kind of out of a need to sort of prove to myself that I could do this. I just started practicing a lot. I didn't practice, early on. Sorry about that, John. But I did eventually start to come into my own and make a lot of improvements. And, I made the top band all four years of high school. My sight reading got a lot better and everything. And then when I was in my junior year, I made district band, and senior year, I made district band again. And what was kind of interesting is that, when I was in district band my junior year, another percussionist that was in that section with me was Kyle Brightwell, who is now in the Boston Symphony Orchestra. And that was kind of the cool thing about Northern Virginia is that there were a lot of great percussionists that came out of the Northern Virginia area. Kyle Brightwell is one. Michael Roberts, who is the principal percussionist of the Oregon Symphony, is also from there. Matt McKay, who is also in the Boston Symphony. Tom Sherwood, of the Cleveland Orchestra and the Modern Snare Drum Competition. He went to Woodson High School, which is in that Fairfax County, Virginia area and everything. So that's how I kind of got started in percussion.
And you'll get the rest of the interview next week for part two with Tim Fierst. Stay tuned. This week's rave is the novel from the year 2000, The Human Stain, written by Philip Roth. The author, who passed away a few years ago, was a prolific writer who wrote novels with specific recurring characters as a feature. One of his most famous characters went by the name of Nathan Zuckerman, who most folks see as a stand-in for the author. He usually plays a secondary role, and in the second set of Zuckerman novels, particularly the fantastic American Pastoral, which is one of the best audiobooks I've ever listened to, these focus on someone else as the main character. In this case, The Human Stain's main character is Coleman Silk, a recently forced into retirement university professor and dean that Zuckerman befriends. The dean, along with his much younger girlfriend, a janitor at the school he worked at, are suddenly killed. And Zuckerman pieces together what happened, both through his friendship with Silk and some personal detective and backstory work. In the midst of doing so, he uncovers secrets held by many of the characters and a fully fleshed out, full character study develops. As mentioned, I have read and enjoyed Roth's work before, but this particular novel felt different and connected better with me. Some of it regarded the fact that the main character is a college professor. Okay, that makes sense. Some of it dealt with the backstory of race and other things that are involved in the novel, which I won't tell you about. But the main reason that this particular work struck a chord with me was in the depiction of a character named Les Farley. In the novel, Farley is the ex-husband of the girlfriend of Coleman Silk and a man struggling. This is someone who had a miserable time as a soldier in Vietnam and came back with a debilitating case of PTSD. It's not even that this character finds himself angry, which happens. It's that for the most part, Les is someone who's numb. Numb to pain, numb to his own suffering, numb to other people's suffering, even numb of the great losses he's suffered in his own life since returning. There are segments in the book where folks have less attempt to be reintroduced to various pockets of society, and the fears and flashbacks he encounters are depicted well. There's this fantastic part where he's being interviewed by a psychologist about recent deaths that he may have been involved in, and it's clear from the back and forth that he just feels nothing about them. There's another part that delves into his boggled mind and a 2 to 3 pages located inside of his brain where this is being depicted convey anger and confusion and struggles incredibly well. You know that someone who is in that kind of mental shape can be a risk to himself and others. It's an enormously intriguing book and well worth your time, and adapted into a relatively decent 2003 film starring Anthony Hopkins and Nicole Kidman. Check out The Human Stain by Philip Roth, available wherever books are sold. And that's our show. Subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts and leave a comment and a rating. You can always find every episode and the show notes at the homepage at petezambito.com/Pete's Percussion Podcast, the episodes. The show is also on SoundCloud, Stitcher, Spotify, and many other podcast locations. If you're on Facebook, like the page Pete's Percussion Podcast. You can find me there on Instagram and Twitter at Pete Zambito or by email at petesperkpod@gmail.com. And I'll catch you next time for part 2 with Tim Fierst. Until then.